Hello, and welcome to the last episode of SG Voices Roundup of the outcomes of COP. I'm joined today by my colleague Julia Bataro. I'm afraid Heather Dinwiddie can't be with us today. Julia, what's your first take on the outcome of COP? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm trying to stay positive, shall we say that?
Okay.
I am. I think we discussed this between us before that hoping for a complete phase out of fossil fuels was probably a bit too ambitious. So we can celebrate the small victories. And yes, the transitioning away of fossil fuels is now made the first appearance on an official text. So that's something to be happy about. If I'm not wrong, already in 2009, at COP 2009, there were plans to do that. And the discussions collapsed. And so there wasn't an agreement on this. So even though this is a positive step towards the right direction, is it a bit late?
Well, I think it's a really, really interesting question. And I think that question relates to our understanding of what the COP process is really meant to be about. Because you're absolutely right. You know, the talks have fallen apart before. That's what I think is exciting about this outcome. The COP process has got every single country that is a member of the UN, and they all have to agree on the language for it to be accepted. And to be honest, there's never been a time when fossil states and the fossil fuel industry has been prepared to accept that. What we've got with this use of the phrase transitioning away from fossil fuels is acceptance and understanding that the only way we're going to have any hope of meeting the Paris goals is to transition away from fossil fuels. We may not have got a time frame we want. We may have a lot of potential loopholes through carbon abatement or looking at geoengineering. But there's an understanding and an acceptance by every member of, you know, by every party to the convention that we have to move away from fossil fuels. That's an incredible achievement when you consider that the event itself was being held in an oil state. What I think is really interesting is how it's going to look over the next couple of years with which oil states, which developed countries, how they're going to choose to move. Because I think one thing that's very interesting and doesn't get discussed enough is that if we're transitioning away from fossil fuels, those states reliant on fossil fuels have got to recognize that. You know, these states have begun diversification, modernization, building up new avenues of revenue. But actually, in many ways, you know, the Gulf states are going to be the last ones standing when it comes to selling oil, for example. They've got the cheapest, sweetest crude. Everyone else is going to have to find a way to work around that. And I think there's going to be a lot of jockeying to see who's going to be the last supplier of oil. And I think what we've got with this thread throughout the negotiations at COP28, and if you think about it, the global stocktake, the recognition that we're so far away from where we need to be, that developed countries, I think, are on average about 40% off the trajectory they need to be on. But what we've actually got is governments around the world actually agreeing to a shift in paradigm. You know, there's a fundamental difference between the expectation that oil and gas are still going to produce the majority of energy in the world, with abatement or not, and a recognition that we're moving away from that model.
Yeah, I suppose that, yeah, I think my concern is about the urgency of what we need to do. Because had this COP result happened maybe 10 years ago, when I wasn't working in sustainability, but, you know, it would have been maybe less bittersweet in a way, because it's like, this is good, but also, you know, we really are running out of time.
I do agree with that. But I think, again, one of the things is to think about the difference between what we need to happen on the ground and the speed at which international policy negotiations can actually take place. One of the things that's been a topic of conversation, and was certainly a topic out in Dubai, was that the COP process always used to have a rhythm of, you know, every 5 years or so, there would be a big push for major ambition. You talk about 2009, you know, a few years later than that, we pushed and got towards the Paris Agreement. But what we're seeing now, if you look over the last couple of COPs, every year there's a push for higher ambition. And what we're really seeing, I think, is a move that sets the direction of travel. And that changes the dynamic for the private sector. The biggest problem we've got is if people think they're going to make large amounts of money from oil and gas, they're just going to keep putting money into oil and gas. But if you're forced to think about the fact that is potentially going to change, you're going to see a different dynamic in the private sector and in the markets. The thing that always gets me excited, and I apologize to anyone who's heard me go on about it before, is insurance. Because if you think about insurance, so many of the safety measures we have in our daily lives, look at seatbelts and airbags in cars, these were all driven by a recognition by insurers that there were really high risks associated with driving. They pushed regulators to put laws into place to make it safer so they didn't have to pay out. If we see a really widespread recognition that this is an issue for insurers, for investors, for companies, let alone for individuals, we really might see a coalition of the willing to push things through on a different level. It's not just the international negotiations that matter. It's how countries react. It's how sectors react. And that's potentially what's exciting. Admittedly, I'm just very upbeat because we got some language in the text and 3 or 4 days ago, I was really miserable.
Yeah. As I said, let's celebrate the victories that we've got. And I think another very important one is about nature, because at this COP, we recognized, there was some recognitions of the link between climate and nature. So, you know, global warming goes hand in hand with ecosystem degradation. So we need to build strategies that incorporate these two elements. And this is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think that's another huge paradigm shift within the discussions. I think that's going to potentially be a huge challenge for the private sector as well. If you think about the amount of time it took for the Financial Stability Board to come up with the TCFD recommendations, so the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, the follow-on from that was the Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosure. The speed at which it was put together and is being implemented is far faster than happens with the climate recommendations. Those are now becoming mandatory in different jurisdictions around the world. Once we see that acceleration, that alignment, that understanding that what happens in nature is going to have a direct impact on operations, on functionality, on economies overall, companies are really going to have to wake up and deal with the fact that just addressing your GHG emissions may not be enough anymore. You're going to have to think about resilience. You're going to have to think about double materiality. I really think the underlying theme of this year's COP is that the conversation has fundamentally changed.
Definitely. I think one key issue here, and something that has been talked extensively across many COPs, is who's going to pay for what?
Yeah, and I think the finance has been a challenge. The numbers that have come out of this year's COP with commitments to climate finance is around 86 billion. That sounds fantastic. Again, there was a lot of debate on the ground about what that actually meant. Was it new money? Or did it exist in an earlier format? Is it money that's going to leverage that amount of commitment? You know, there was $3 billion from the US, but is that going to get through Congress? There are lots of caveats around what's been promised. I think that perhaps the thing I regret most is there were no targets for finance for the global goal on adaptation. Because, and I understand it's difficult to set them, but the gap between climate finance and nature finance is so enormous. The need for adaptation finance is, there simply are no words for how much money we've got to find and channel to the right places. And there was a lot of talk about blended finance, which has historically been the way a lot of climate finance has been deployed, you know, using guarantees or insurance to lower the risk of investments to bring in the private sector. I think we're going to have to get a lot more innovative than that.
Definitely. And I think it again speaks about the sense of urgency, because one of the many studies that were published at COP talked about the fact that, you know, through the lens of nature finance, there is $7 trillion being spent every year in destroying nature. You know, obviously that's not the main purpose of these investments, but that's what happens. So if we don't address these issues, if we don't spend probably more than that in protecting nature, then we're just going to have more costs down the line, exponentially bigger than what they are now. And so again, it's about, we need to do this as soon as possible, because these costs just balloon every year.
I think what's fascinating about that is when you talk about the amount of money being invested with negative consequences, you're talking a lot about subsidies. There's been debates about fossil fuel subsidies for years. This year, we've seen discussions about subsidies for industrialized agriculture. We've seen the fossil fuel industry really center stage as, you know, taking it on the chin for climate change. But that's going to spill over. There's going to be a cascade effect. You know, the dairy and the meat industries are definitely in the sights of those taking action on climate change. And that's going to spill into every other sector too. We've seen this increase in reporting. We've got the CSRD coming in Europe next year. But look at GDPR. That was a European law. And think of the implications it's had in other countries. Once you have a framework where you have to follow the rules in a certain way, companies start to have approaches that are similar across different jurisdictions because it's easier to have one approach. If you think about the growth in reporting and demand for information, you've got Europe with the CSRD and you've got California, which has implemented its own climate reporting rules. The SEC has got to come out with something. We're now expecting it in Q1, Q2 of next year, massively delayed, you know, I think probably for political reasons. But there is a real shift in the expectations of how to behave. And I think people in the private sector don't really yet get quite how dramatically and how rapidly things are going to change in the next 18 months. I mean, obviously, the next COP is in Azerbaijan, which is a oil-dependent state. So that's going to be an issue again. Possibly the most challenging thing that happened at this COP was the failure of agreement on Article 6, which is the compliance carbon markets. Obviously, we all know there have been challenges in the voluntary carbon markets over the last year or so. And there was real hope that agreement of the rules for an international mechanism at the UN level would result in a standardized set of rules where everyone would understand what good quality was, what high integrity credits were. There were discussions about whether technological removal should be involved or whether it should, you know, be something that is nature-based and the protection of rainforests, this sort of thing. We haven't had those rules. And because of the way it happened, I mean, basically, they just seem to run out of time. But nothing more can happen on that work stream until next year. So I think there are going to be delays to action on the carbon markets. And whether you like markets or not, the amount of money that needs to be channeled to net zero and nature positive economic operation is so enormous that we have to use every tool we've got. That doesn't mean that we should use tools badly. So I think it is better that we got no deal than a really bad deal. But there's an awful lot of work to do to build up confidence so that companies can take action within their own operations and their own supply chains, but also be able to move beyond that, move beyond the value chain, actually spend money doing good and making it work for them.
Do you think this is a step back in the challenge of rebuilding trust in the voluntary carbon markets?
It's difficult to say whether it's a challenge or not. The markets are very different. One of the issues was that Article 6.2, which is basically was agreed last year, is that that allows more flexibility. That's country-to-country operations. The issue with 6.4, which is the international mechanism for carbon trading, is that the idea that there's less flexibility. You can't have a country that says, well, I'm going to have a carbon price of $40 for this particular project here, and I'm going to sell that to, you know, from Guatemala to, I don't know, France. I think it may light a fire under what's actually going on in the voluntary carbon markets. There's an alliance between a bunch of those groups that play different roles in the voluntary carbon markets in tracking things. So I think it was the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, CDP, the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Markets, a whole bunch of them, basically all got together and said they're going to work together to try and improve things. Generally speaking, over time, the voluntary carbon markets have been very iterative. You know, they've worked in and around the compliance mechanisms, but they're early stage, they're learning. I think there is a long way to go. And I wish we'd come out of the negotiations with an agreement on the rules. But the voluntary carbon markets aren't going away. You know, it is a tool that we need both for finance, but also for companies to be able to start moving forward. So I've got my fingers crossed.
just to recap, at COP29 in Azerbaijan, there will definitely be a focus on Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. And then there will be potentially a new climate finance goal.
We hope.
And then at COP30 in Brazil, we will see the national determined contributions updates following the global stocktake this year. So there is a lot to look forward to over the next couple of years.
And actually, I think that's something that's really worth paying attention to, because there was a ministerial between the Climate Convention and the Global Biodiversity Framework, and recommendations to align biodiversity plans with climate plans to integrate the two together. If nations start doing that, companies are going to have to respond. And I actually think there's the potential, if regulation is put in place, and I don't necessarily mean laws saying you have to do X, Y, Z, but regulations to say you have to report on what you're doing. If there's a growth in transparency and a real science-based understanding of impact, then we could really accelerate the speed at which we do transform the economy.
Again, fingers crossed.
Okay, on that note, I think that was a very whistle-stop tour of where we stand at the end of COP. So that's a wrap on our COP28 series. Thank you for listening. We still have our regular episodes of Sustainable Growth Out Loud and SG Voice Talks too, which you can find on all major podcast platforms. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel so you never miss an episode. Thanks again.